Welcome to The Dark State, where we delve deep into pressing security issues shaping our world today. I'm John Mooney, your host, and today we have the honor of speaking with Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware, co-authors of God, Guns, and Sedition, Far-Right Terrorism in America. Bruce is a distinguished scholar and a leading authority on terrorism and insurgency, with the extensive experience advising government agencies, including the US government, on national security matters. Jacob is a prominent researcher specializing in extremism and terrorism, with a focus on the far right. Together, they have produced a groundbreaking analysis of white supremacy, exploring its historical roots, contemporary manifestations, and the urgent challenges it presents to our democratic societies. Join us as we unpack the intricacies of this critical issue with Bruce and Jacob. Gentlemen, welcome to The Dark State. Could I ask both of you to tell me a little bit about yourselves? And Bruce, I'll go to you first.
Thank you, John, very much for having us on The Dark State. We're delighted to be with you. To explain my background, I'm a senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States, and I'm also a professor at Georgetown University. I've been studying terrorism literally for nearly 50 years, since I first went to graduate school in 1976. And with respect to the subject of our book, Violent Far-Right Extremism, when I first began my career as an analyst in 1981, the first account that I had was violent far-right extremism, initially in Europe, because in 1980, there had been a series of attacks, a bombing at the Bologna rail station in Italy, a bombing at the Oktoberfest celebration in Munich, then West Germany, and a machine gun attack on a synagogue on the Rue Copernic in Paris. And it struck me 43 years ago that this was a development that people weren't paying sufficient attention to. And in fact, it produced my first professional ever publication. But then interestingly and significantly, by the middle of the 1980s, I had widened the aperture of my research and was also focusing on terrorism generally in the United States. There were certainly a number of radical, violent left-wing organizations. There were militant ethno-nationalist separatist terrorist groups active in the U.S., but the movement that really I thought was the most potentially consequential and lethal was the violent far-right movement in the United States. And to conclude, I have to admit that about the last thing I ever imagined up until a few years ago was writing about this movement yet again. I studied it extensively in the 1980s and 1990s, and then, like terrorism analysts everywhere, after September 11th, 2001, my attention was wrenched onto the Middle East and South Asia and other places where Salafi jihadi terrorist groups were active. So I was quite surprised to return to this issue and to produce a book on it. But that, I think, is an indication of how serious a problem and a threat this movement has become, both in the United States and elsewhere, especially in Europe, in recent years.
Jacob, what provoked your interest in this subject?
Well, thank you, first of all, so much for having me, John. It's a real honor. I'm a research fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where I work with and for Bruce, based here in Washington, D.C., and I'm also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. You know, John, here in D.C., when you walk through any sort of government, you know, security building, or you talk to other security professionals in think tanks, you'll find that there is a class of people in our city who were motivated and mobilized into government service or into working on this topic by 9/11. That was not the case for me. I was 6 years old on 9/11, so it's less of a pivotal moment for me, more just defining. Obviously, I grew up in a post 9/11 era. The pivotal moment for me occurred on July 22nd, 2011, a moment that we talk about at length in our book, which is the devastating twin terrorist attack that struck Oslo and nearby Utøya Island in Norway. 77 people were killed there, and I think it was the first salvo in this new generation of far-right violence that very much became the form of terrorism that people were studying as I came of age as a researcher. So when Bruce and I began our work together in September 2019 and then began the book process in April 2020, we were already well into our studies on this topic. It was already a major issue. It was a post-Christchurch world. And so Bruce and I think have sadly been forced to pick this up as this issue very quickly and very suddenly became a national security emergency, both here in the United States, but obviously in Europe and in New Zealand and beyond as well.
Okay, so Bruce, I want to discuss what is sometimes perceived as a fringe ideology. Yet your book argues that it possesses it poses a significant threat to democracy. Could you elaborate on this perspective?
Sure. The book really begins in the early 1980s, although it traces this movement back to the post-American Civil War and the emergence of the Ku Klux Klan during the Reconstruction period, and then again in the 19-teens and the 1920s and in the 1960s. But it really takes as its jumping off point the 1980s. And Jacob and I saw a lot of similarities to the world, both in 2020 and today. Firstly, then as now, the United States was just coming off of multi-decade-long involvements in overseas military expeditions, back then in Indochina, that also hadn't gone terribly well, certainly had not produced any kind of a decisive victory. The United States economy, and especially the uncertainty of how it would survive COVID, for example, was very reminiscent of a difficult period in the late 1970s when inflation rates were in 17-18%, when people were very concerned of the impact of the farm crisis, for instance, on the U.S. economy, not least on American agricultural economics, and also when immigration was a flashpoint both then and now. And what we saw in the 1980s was this movement pivoting away from the simple racism, anti-Semitism, xenophobia, anti-Catholicism of previous eras of hate in the United States and adopting a much more strident and discernible anti-government, even seditious mindset. But the difference is back then, these were fairly isolated, geographically disparate individuals and sometimes ephemeral groups that were attempting to launch this revolution or uprising against the United States and really got very little traction. And in fact, were almost entirely shunned or dismissed by mainstream politicians. But you fast forward that to the recent decade, 21st century and even today, and you find that social media has almost hypersonically empowered them and enabled a connectivity that would have been unimaginable 40 years ago. And equally unimaginable, we have mainstream, very prominent political figures and leaders voicing and expressing some of the same phrasing and the same rhetoric of what you correctly describe as a very fringe and extremist way of thinking. In other words, giving it top cover.
Hmm. I was really taken aback by your references to the fact that some of these groups back in the heyday, they actually wanted to replicate the IRA's campaign as an Irish national. That really struck me as odd because I would have seen those two groups having nothing in common whatsoever.
Well, it's true. You're absolutely right, John. They have nothing in common. And in fact, many of these extremist, violent far-right American groups or anti-Catholic as they are, let's say anti-Semitic. I mean, you know, Papists and some of the same rhetoric that one sees in the Northern Ireland conflict are evident here. It's more a conscious emulation of what they saw was the success of both Republican and Loyalist paramilitary groups in plunging Northern Ireland, well, and Ireland itself in the 19-teens and the 1920s, into violence that threatened the governmental structure of what was then British rule of Ireland, but subsequently became British rule and the incorporation of Northern Ireland into the United Kingdom after partition. So it's not so much an ideological affinity as much as a tactical one. They looked at the success of Republican and Loyalist paramilitaries as providing a model that could be emulated in the United States.
That part of the book was actually fascinating for someone like me. Jacob, how has the landscape of white supremacy evolved over the years? Now, I know you've explored this in a great detail in this book, but what factors have contributed to its resurgence in recent times? And maybe before I go on further, Ireland has witnessed a series of arson attacks in recent months, whereby proposed emigration centres are now being torched and burnt down by sort of anti-migrant far-right groups. And this is happening almost on a monthly basis at this stage. It's become this huge issue in Ireland. So we're not immune to this. This isn't solely an American phenomenon or some, you know, far-off places. This is happening everywhere. Can you just talk the listeners through what do you feel is leading to this resurgence?
Happy to. So in terms of that first part of your question, how the landscape has evolved, I would argue it's both evolved and stayed the same. And I'm going to answer all these questions, hopefully, by zooming out a little bit and talking about a conspiracy theory, which is deeply embedded in this movement and inspires a lot of the violence. That conspiracy theory is called Great Replacement Theory, or Replacement Theory. So there are some kind of misconceptions that this theory first emerged in France in the 2010s. Bruce and I, in our work, actually trace it all the way back to the US Civil War, and I'm sure it goes before that too. Great Replacement Theory argues that there is a deliberate replacement ongoing of Western white masculinity through things like immigration, African-American and other minority rights, LGBTQ plus rights, abortion. But that's only half of the conspiracy theory. There's another half which says that this replacement is actually being coordinated, orchestrated by some kind of cabal or group of elites that are probably Jewish and are Marxists and are feminists. What this really means is you have this big tent conspiratorial landscape through which different individuals can kind of implement their own personal views. Now, the reason I'm saying that this means that things both change and shift, or change and stay the same, is looking back throughout the past 150 years of extremism that we trace in our book, different enemies emerge at different points for this movement, but they can all be subsumed under that one conspiracy theory. So whether it's Catholic immigrants, right, during an earlier era of the KKK, or its freedmen and other black southerners during Reconstruction, or its Jews as part of kind of a World War II era Nazism, or more recently its immigration from places like, you know, the Middle East in Europe, or Latin America here in the US. The conspiracy theory is so flexible, so malleable, that it allows these groups to really implement things that are happening in the world into their worldview and keep it going and sustain it. So I think that's what's being seen in Ireland. I think that's how what's happening in Ireland can be traced back to, for example, what's happening in the US. And I'll say that Britain has also suffered dearly from this violence, right? In 2016, during the Brexit vote, a member of parliament who was seen as pro-migrant was murdered, assassinated by a neo-Nazi inspired by Great Replacement Theory. So this conspiracy theory and the violence it inspires finds ways to continue to regenerate as new trends emerge in politics and as new groups emerge that can be subsumed under that conspiracy theory. Now, what is leading to a resurgence in recent times? I think you can point to a number of things, but let me quickly jump back in time to 2008, which was a particularly important year for Great Replacement Theory and for far-right extremism and white supremacy, because the United States saw the election of the first African-American president in our history, which for many people was a sign of great racial progress and unity, and for others was a sign that tyranny was taking place, that replacement theory was true, that white people were losing, and that of course led to a spike in violence. And over the next several years during his administration, you saw both a number of acts of violence in the United States and abroad, but you also had an incredibly significant development for extremism writ large, and that is the emergence of social media. And today, social media is the front line. It is the battlefield of modern domestic terrorism, and it has been a tremendous accelerant for these ideologies, which can now project right into somebody's bedroom or living room and inspire newcomers to the movement who are able to break off those networks and cause new acts of violence. It has been arguably the most significant terrorist development or development for terrorist groups, and it remains a serious issue for us.
Bruce, I'll return to you. Your book discusses the role of technology, and Jacob has kind of referred to it there, and social media in facilitating the spread of supremacist ideologies. I suppose, how significant is this influence, and what measures can be taken to address this? Now, when I say that, I'm very much aware that, certainly in Ireland, Irish far-right activists are being completely influenced by what's happening in the States rather than Europe. There is that cultural affinity between Ireland and the US which is coming to the fore. And I've often wondered aloud, because we've seen this before, whereby Irish America supported the Provisional IRA and Irish America supported the Fenian movement before them. And I often wonder, is this history repeating itself in a different context, in a slightly different context? But could you maybe offer your opinions on what measures can be taken to address this now?
Well, firstly, John, you're absolutely right to call attention to the far-right extremism that has emerged in Ireland. And to an extent, you know, has a number of commonalities with the United States, not least controversial embrace of how best to deal with immigration, for example. And of course, the rioting that we saw in Ireland brief time ago was very disturbing. It's interesting, in terms of countermeasures, to my mind, the path was sort of lit in 2019 when in the United Kingdom, a collaborative effort between the Home Office and the Ministry of Digital Media, Sport and Culture, or Culture, Sport, and Digital Media, together produced the Online Harms White Paper, which attempted to lay out for the first time that I'm aware of a government's responsibility to its citizens in the digital era, and laid out what citizens should expect of government in pushing back against social media high-tech companies that have monetized algorithms that promote not just political extremism, but pedophilia, for example, or body shaming or bullying or intolerance. And it was a very ambitious effort. The white paper was, I think, quite interesting and quite comprehensive. The idea was that that it would be introduced in the fall of 2019 or winter of 2020 in the British Parliament to be enacted into legislation, or at least parts of it. But of course, the continuing fallout from Brexit, the succession of British governments, and then COVID completely derailed it. So it's still out there, but there hasn't been any progress. But I think that provides a model or a template that other democracies can follow and adopt to come to grips with a technological entity that, at least in Jacob and my estimation, has shown itself incapable of policing the content on its platforms, and that has had very serious and sometimes dire lethal consequences for society. So in the U.S. context, we talk about reform of something known as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And without going into the details of that, because of course in the United States, the Constitution and the First Amendment guarantees free speech and presents some challenges that don't exist in other country. The point that both Jacob and I fasten on in the final chapter, which is the policy recommendations, is that almost across the board, the law has not kept pace with technology. Now, admittedly, Europe and the EU is holding the tech giants to an accountability that has not yet really materialized in the United States. But everything that we write about shows why this movement has gained such traction and has become so consequential. And it really does boil down to the connectivity and the networking that has been enabled by social media and the internet. And let me just give you one very specific example so your listeners don't think I'm constantly speaking in generalities. In June 2020, with my not very advanced technological or technical skills in the digital world, I mean, I was able to find really endless, many platforms on Facebook that were openly advocating for the overthrow of the United States government. Now, they used very clever language, like they call themselves the Boogaloo. That's kind of the code name for overthrowing the United States government. But this is something that was absolutely astonishing to me. And it turned out that this variety of platforms, and as I said, there were many Facebook channels that were advocating this, you know, at that time frame had upward of 75,000 members agreed with it. I mean, that's chilling in a democracy. And especially in the lead up to a very important presidential election, that you had so many Americans who believed that there was a reason in a liberal democracy to use violence to change government. And that sentiment has been borne out, unfortunately, now several times annually by polls conducted by the University of Maryland and the newspaper, The Washington Post, that show roughly a third of Americans believe in certain circumstances violence would be justified against the United States government, against a democratically elected government. That, to me, is just astonishing.
Absolutely. And most people listening to this would be amazed at those sort of findings, because there is a perception, right or wrongly, that America would be the most stable and robust democratic system in the world, but yet it's producing this. Jacob, can I ask you, what are the common misconceptions about white supremacy that you aim to debunk? I mean, I always thought of groups like the KKK that were kind of almost amateur affairs. I didn't realize they'd been involved in so many killings. I was very ignorant about this. But could you, I suppose, talk me through the misconceptions about these? People tend to view them in one way, but the reality is very, very different.
I would agree with that. Let me first just make a quick note on your first point there, which is, you know, I think a lot of the people do look to the United States as being an exemplar of democracy and electoral integrity. But I'm not sure that that's the case anymore, John. And I think you saw that in January 2023, where an election riot occurred in Brazil, driven by very similar grievances, a very similar mob. So there is a new American soft power emerging in a way that is very concerning and in a way that is inspiring other actors, other similarly anti-democratic or anti-government actors to realize that rejecting elections and launching attacks in response are legitimate activities. And this is an election year, by the way, where we have 50 elections at least around the world. And I think if anybody's looking at the US right now thinking that's the exemplar, then that's not necessarily a good thing. And I think that is a shift that we have to understand and kind of heed right now. But let me answer your other question about some of the misconceptions, because I think you're touching on something really interesting there, which is there is most certainly here in the United States and abroad a conception that the white supremacist movement here or the anti-government movement here is largely rural, right, poorly educated, of low economic standing. And I don't think that that's true. Obviously, there's versatility here and there's different actors that engage, but this movement has for a long time actually thought ways both to appeal to different constituencies and also to legitimize themselves by entering, for example, government. And we've seen this in activities or in moments like Charlottesville, which was a real sort of moment at which the movement entered the mainstream, I would say. So this happened in August 2017. There was this rally that was set for Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th, 2017, where white supremacists and neo-Nazis were going to gather to protest the removal of a Confederate statue of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general. Now, the Confederacy, obviously, was the breakaway state during the Civil War that sought to protect slavery in the South. So the symbol of that statue is kind of a symbol of white supremacy, right? And it's a symbol of that statue being removed is taken by white supremacists to mean that their views, but more generally sort of, you know, white pride is being eroded. They gathered at Unite the Right rally. Somebody committed a terrorist attack there. They sort of wore chinos and polo shirts, kind of trying to advance an image of themselves as clean cut, as almost student-like. This occurred on a university campus, while they were chanting these very vicious anti-Semitic and white supremacist slogans. And then in the days that followed that event, President Trump had this very consequential kind of back and forth with the media where he really struggled to condemn them. And he eventually said these immortal words that were very fine people on both sides. That was taken by the movement as being that top cover that Bruce spoke about earlier, as being that that protection of the movement. And I think that's one way that people, I think, overlook how woven into some mainstream parts of our society this movement is. And it's not, you know, a southern phenomenon of country racists who are mobilizing against, you know, northerners. This is very much a national movement that transcends education. It transcends economic status. The movement exists in major cities in the United States and beyond. And so it's much broader, much more integrated than we would like to believe.
Bruce, if I could ask you next, this movement is intersecting with other type of extremist groups. Could you maybe elaborate on these connections and what are their implications?
This movement in and of itself has always styled itself as a big tent. In other words, I think like all terrorist movements throughout history, there's a constant search for new constituents and there's a desire to broaden the potential demographic of sympathizers and supporters. And that's one reason the movement changed so dramatically, as I discussed earlier, from, let's say, you know, the white sheets and the conical hats of the Ku Klux Klan or the brown shirts and Sam Brown belts of the American Nazi Party, to something that that was wearing business suits, that was talking about a variety of political issues that went beyond just simple hatred, racism, and intolerance, and that sought to bring in a diversity of people, militant opponents of legalized abortion in the United States, for example, zealous exponents of Second Amendment rights, that is the right to bear arms, persons who were opposed to taxation, for example, or opposed to any form of government above the county level and believed that the local sheriff was the highest authority one had to pay any attention to. And all these, the attempt in the 1980s was to bring them all together and to have something that appealed to everyone, but then to unite them, which is what Jacob and I found so disturbing, in this very strident and openly expressed opposition to the United States government, which back in the 1980s and even to this day, extremists will refer to as ZOG, Z-O-G, the Zionist Occupation Government. I mean, that's how entrenched they think the deep state is, and that, of course, going back to the classical anti-Semitic text of the early 20th century, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, that this was all part of a Jewish plot and conspiracy. But as Jacob and I have been discussing, what's been such a troubling development is in the 21st century is that this, on the one hand, this big tent conceptualization of drawing people in on a multiplicity of grievances has continued and weaponized by social media has proven highly effective, but that you have significant leading political figures voicing in sometimes identical rhetoric, as Jason described, and articulating the views of what was once a fringe and unfortunately making them more mainstream in the United States. And we've already seen this in the run-up to the 2024 presidential election when one candidate in particular has been using rhetoric that has been cited as reminiscent, for instance, of Mein Kampf, My Struggle, talking about poisoning the blood of a nation. So channeling foundational messages of hatred and intolerance that would have been completely unacceptable or even unheard of some presidential elections ago are now, unfortunately, becoming typical.
Jacob, if I could go to you next, what are the strategies that are being employed by these groups to recruit and radicalize people online?
Well, I think if we had a perfect answer to that question, we would be doing a far more effective job at pushing back. Let me talk about one channel. I think one of the really difficult, even upsetting conclusions that I have found from the research is in modern times, the rise of personal vulnerabilities, personal factors in recruitment and radicalization in the violent far right. Personal factors meaning a variety of issues, such as mental health issues, a history of being bullied, a history of violence in the home, even very specific things sometimes like parental suicides. These factors might lead to what I think you can think about as almost a typology of vulnerability. That some groups are able to mend. So if you are somebody, for example, who has been floating through life, you're 16 years old, you've been floating through life, you've been bullied, you've never quite made friends, you've never quite belonged to anything, there is a very effective message that comes from white supremacist groups through social media that effectively says, you don't belong because the world is against you, because the world is against white people. The world is against white men. And in fact, you do belong to something because you belong to a great race. And if you come with us, you will see that we will restore our race, our clan to supremacy again. And all of a sudden, those people who have felt worthless, unappreciated, outcasts, all of a sudden aren't that anymore. In fact, they're the exact opposite, right? They sit on top of the social food chain. And they have a right to treat people a certain way. They have a right to violence on behalf of their ideologies. That has proved an intoxicating message for far too many people. And we don't, I think, have a really reliable, rock solid counter to that. Even if it's relying on conspiracy theories, even if it's relying on age old hatreds, we haven't found a way to respond effectively at scale on social media companies. To give you just one example of what this looks like, John, I'll point to a group that I've done a lot of work on called the Atomwaffen Division, which was a neo-Nazi group active in kind of 2017, 2018. That group was founded by an individual called Brandon Russell and was responsible for 5 murders perpetrated by 3 murderers. When you look at Brandon Russell and those 3 killers who were some of the original leaders of the group, you find that all 4 of those individuals had autism spectrum disorder and at least one other mental illness. When you have genuine, legitimate neo-Nazi terrorist organizations who are mobilizing and radicalizing people with that kind of vulnerability, autism spectrum disorder and another mental illness, something is broken, either in our society or in our reaction or our relationship with social media or just in our counterterrorism responses. Something along the line has failed. And I still don't think 6 or 7 years later, I don't think we've made any progress on combating that form of radicalization and recruitment.
And Jacob, could I ask you, is this the case that policymakers, legislators, and indeed security services, that they simply don't understand this?
It's a range of factors, I think, John. So here in the United States, for example, government can't do that much on social media because we have the First Amendment here, which means that really the vast majority of hateful rhetoric, of racism, of white supremacist material that's online is not illegal at all. It's very much protected free speech under the First Amendment. So they have their hands tied a little bit until it crosses a line of criminality, right? Like explicit violent threats. And so it's not necessarily solely government responsibility. We, Bruce and I, come down very hard in our policy recommendations on social media companies, in particular asking for the reform of something called Section 230, which is part of the United States Communications Decency Act, which basically protects social media companies from being held liable for content on their apps, on their platforms. So social media companies are not responsible for information that is posted or held on their platforms. What this means is that when somebody tries to, for example, sue Facebook or Twitter saying that, hey, you were responsible for the individual's radicalization who ended up killing my family member, they can't do that. We basically argue that social media companies, as I mentioned, they're the front line, they're the battlefield of extremism today. They have to be responsible for that content. They have to take the lead in that battle. And if they don't, we are going to be treading water, frankly, in counterterrorism, because the access to radical information and the ease of radicalization on social media and other online forums is so rampant. It's so easy. And so, yes, government, I think, need to do more in certain cases, like January 6th, for example, where government had plentiful intelligence that something like that was going to happen and they did not adequately prepare. But we also can't remember that all of those, the vast majority of the threats, the planning that were issued with regards to January 6th were issued in public forums, on social media platforms, where the social media platforms did not take responsibility for moderating or removing or trying to counter that planning and that radical information. And in that environment, counterterrorism is just going to be extremely difficult.
Bruce, we've touched on this already, but this book touches on the international dimensions of white supremacist movements. Specifically, how do these movements transcend national boundaries, and what challenges does this present to various governments across the world? And a lot of listeners in Ireland and Britain and elsewhere will be very interested in your views on this. As I say, we have a significant problem now that is developing in Ireland, where these groups have become very violent. They're carrying out attacks. They burned down part of inner city Dublin there a couple of months ago, and we all watched astonishing scenes unfold on our televisions on the night that of those particular riots. Some of this has been influenced by people in the US, and I've spoken to some of these people, and I'm sometimes confounded by their opinions. They don't seem to know an awful lot about Ireland, but they have developed audiences here, and I'm sure they have elsewhere. Could you just talk me through how that is happening?
Yes, and you're hitting the nail on the head in that this movement has always aspired to be transnational, and is why this historical trajectory that Jacob and I trace in the book is so fascinating. Because in the 1980s, this movement was already attempting to develop international connections. In fact, I would argue that the two most consequential trends in terrorism in the 21st century have been lone wolf or lone actor attacks. For example, that ISIS was very successful and inspiring in many places across Europe and in the United States, Australia, and elsewhere. And also radicalization and recruitment through digital media. Now, we reflexively associate those two highly consequential developments with terrorist groups in the Middle East and South Asia. That's not the case. In fact, both of those innovations emerged in the early 1980s in the United States. The lone actor or lone wolf phenomena was designed to obviate or to overcome the success that the FBI and the authorities were having in planting or cultivating confidential informants within these groups or infiltrating them with law enforcement officers. So the idea was move away from pyramidal, hierarchical, command and control terrorist groups to individuals or small cells of individuals being inspired, motivated, and ultimately animated to carry out acts of violence. And of course, the exemplar of this was Timothy McVeigh, the U.S. Army veteran who carried out, until September 11th, 2001, the most lethal terrorist attack in the history of the United States, the 1995 bombing of a federal office building in Oklahoma City that claimed the lives of 168 persons. I mean, he was exactly adhering to this strategy, as it were, of a lone wolf. And then in terms of the digital media radicalization and recruitment, the same person, his name was Louis Beam, who came up with the idea of what he called leaderless resistance, and we now associate with lone wolf or lone actor attacks. He's the one who also had the idea of completely circumventing very stringent federal laws on sending hate mail internationally that was getting white supremacists thrown in jail for basically mail fraud. He seized on something completely new and novel at the time, desktop computers that admittedly had 48K memory, which is about a single letter of the alphabet or a number on a PowerPoint slide today, that very cumbersomely and slowly transmitted information, not images, not certainly not moving images or memes, but just strictly very slowly communicated text on something called a modem, which from the film from decades ago, You've Got Mail, you know, it had that very distinctive sound and then the connection when you dialed up with a phone. So that, you know, firstly, the lone actor, of course, and lone wolf was exported elsewhere. And similarly, the internet and social media became a way for like-minded hate mongers in a number of different countries to make these connections. To the point now, something else that has just completely astonished Jacob and myself is that, look, in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, 2001, the United States and the United Kingdom, among other countries, rightly called out countries like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and criticized them for allowing a poisonous ideology, which was religious extremism at the time, to be exported by their countries. Well, I hear regularly from people in Europe that they view the United States now in a very similar light, in that the United States is exporting this ideology. Now, Canada, America's closest ally, the longest open border, I think, in the history of mankind, a country that has extremely close trade relations and very similar cultures. Canada, astonishingly, has designated five U.S.-based organizations as foreign terrorist organizations, as exactly as many countries designate Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and various other groups. The United Kingdom has designated two U.S.-based groups as foreign terrorist organizations. Australia has designated one. Now, think about that. Not only are these three countries some of America's closest allies, but we're also part of the Five Eyes process. In other words, countries that are so similar that engage in the regularized sharing of the most sensitive intelligence. So this is astonishing that some of America's closest allies are designating groups based in the United States as terrorist groups and who are inspiring and motivating and informing like-minded hate mongers, as I said, elsewhere in the world, whether it's Ireland, the United Kingdom, the Scandinavian countries, Europe, Eastern Europe, Australia, and elsewhere.
It's incredible. Finally, this book suggests this movement in its various guises might try to trigger some type of more serious terrorist campaign in an attempt to ignite a civil war in the US. Now, I know there's a lot of people listening to me when I say that and kind of throwing their eyes up to heaven and saying that couldn't happen. But having read your book, I was really concerned about that concept and that proposition. And I'd like you both to outline why this is not really a fanciful idea, but this is a very real threat. I'm not for a moment suggesting America is going to fall into a civil war, but you could see some sort of prolonged terrorist campaign emanating from within America, something that many years ago people would have simply said couldn't happen. Bruce, could I go to you first and ask you for your thoughts on that?
John, I mean, you're exactly right. Many people said that January 6th, 2021 couldn't happen. And we saw how perilously close we came to democracy in the United States being threatened. And what had been a formal standard, if somewhat boring, process of the U.S. Electoral College confirming who was the next president of the United States was literally almost overturned, and that we saw rioting, disorder, bloodshed at the United States Capitol. I think it would be prudent, as Thomas Jefferson very famously said over two centuries ago, to recall that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. This is absolutely right. In terms of something that we talked about a few moments ago, the situation in Northern Ireland, the troubles being replicated in the United States. Well, this is something that our former boss at the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, who was actually for many years a negotiator, following the Good Friday Accords in Northern Ireland, has expressed as a potentiality. I mean, that's different from a possibility, but a potentiality that this is something that could happen in the United States. So I think the good news, such as it is that when people talk about a civil war, I think the reality or the likelihood of a civil war, such as the American Civil War that was waged between 1861 and 1865, that killed the most Americans in any war in the United States' history, that fortunately is unlikely. But I think, as Richard Haass points out, that some version of the troubles coming to the United States, as other academics have also written about, is not entirely far-fetched. And this is not an editorial comment on whether the United States should or shouldn't have a Second Amendment that's a constitutional guarantee of the right to bear firearms. It's just a statement of fact that, for instance, in 2020, 17 million firearms were sold in the United States, a record number. So the U.S. is a very well-armed country with more than one firearm per citizen. So those who might be inclined to engage in violence, it obviously is a minority. It's an extreme fringe. But the trouble is, in a country like the United States, they can be extremely well-armed and therefore have the potential for violence, bloodshed, and mayhem on what could be an even more terrifying scale than we saw, much more modestly, unfortunately, was derailed on January 6, 2021.
Jacob, could I get your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing, John, sat here talking to you and listening to Bruce, that the way that we frame this issue in our book is civil war is not something that can be dismissed out of hand. It's unlikely because of certain the geographic elements that I discussed earlier, right? It's not like you have areas of the country that would be able to fully break off from each other. But it's amazing thinking that the troubles and having that kind of violence is almost an optimistic scenario at this point. I think that's quite shocking. That we would have sustained widespread violence against civilians on a national scale, and that would be a better situation than a worse alternative, I think is a sobering thought about how far we have we've slipped as a country. The last thing I'll say, just to add some context to this, is terrorism analysts or counterterrorism analysts often look at threats as a factor of intent and capability. Bruce just laid out the capability right there. We have an enormous amount of firearms in this country. That means we have an enormous capability to conduct violence, which means you have to get intent down somehow. You have to get people to be less inclined towards violence. And the problem, as Bruce outlined earlier, is it's actually going the other way, John. Mm. Intent to violence is rising. People are more inclined to commit acts of violence, and they have the capability to do so. So it's really hard to think of a scenario in which this gets better before it gets worse. And as we've seen with acts of violence at Charleston, South Carolina, at Charlottesville, Virginia, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Poway, California, El Paso, Texas, Buffalo, New York, Jacksonville, Florida, we are already seeing very high levels of sustained white supremacist and neo-Nazi violence in the United States. And I don't think it gets better anytime soon. I wish I could end with something more optimistic, John, but I think that is the frightening reality that we are in as a nation today.
Well, on that rather depressing note, but very realistic note, I would like to thank Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware for sharing their insights and expertise on the topic of white supremacy, and particularly what's happening in the United States. I would certainly recommend this book to everyone. We appreciate your dedication to confronting this threat and fostering a more inclusive and resilient democratic order. So thank you for joining us today on The Dark State, and thank you to listener for joining. Until we speak again, do take care.